Good morning, Hemp Rising, rather. Hence the name of our show. We don't want to be mourning, boo-hoo. We want to be rising, elevating, lifting, going higher. So I hope everyone is having a lovely morning here. I'm just getting up. It's 8 o'clock on the West Coast. Good morning, Los Angeles. It's nice and sunny and clear here today. We've had oodles of rain. I'm sure you guys have all heard. So we're just shaking off and trying to soak up some of the sun. We have a really great show scheduled for today. I've been a little extra excited, I guess I could say, for this show more than the usual, maybe because it's going to be two female guests that are going to be joining us today, which is, you know, exciting for me, even though I'm producer and I'm supposed to stay in the back manning the studio and controls. But definitely, it's going to be a really great episode. These are some really incredible, pioneer, innovative, dynamic women that are really just doing it and leading the the hemp community industry in Kansas. But, you know, strategically, I think, as we will hear more about, Kansas is, you know, because of its central location, and it's obvious, if you don't know, check it out. Kansas has a very deep, rich hemp history. As I think at one time it was the nation's number one producer of hemp, back during the 40s when the war effort was in full motion. And there's still, I think, feral, quote unquote, I hate using that word for cannabis, but feral, they call feral hemp fields there in Kansas that have, you know, survived all the government's eradication attempts over the decades. And there's land race strains. We don't call them that anymore. Varieties that of, you know, indigenous hemp that has been growing there probably for, we don't know, maybe hundreds, thousands of years. So I love that, you know, that history that and the legacy that Kansas brings. And I think that they're hopefully going to, you know, look to that as they're getting close, I think, to making some votes and changes. I'm not too familiar. I for me, I need to do more of my homework on this, but not totally familiar on their whole legislative or regulatory structure. So we'll hear more about that today from are going to be joining us. And oh, there they are. And without further ado, we can welcome to the studio my host of the show, Josh Snyder.
Good morning.
Good morning, Josh. How are you?
If I was any better, I'd be you.
Well, at least it's not raining here in LA. I'm glad to see the sun shining. I was just sharing with the folks that are listening. We get to dry off a little today, hopefully, and get some warm rays from the sun. But yeah, just was rambling as well about Kansas and just, you know, how it's really, even though there's still no medical cannabis there, you know, it's got such a deep rich hemp history. And additionally, it's, you know, probably why it's got the rich history is because, you know, of its positioning, and it's just so centrally located. And there's just so many things about it that really lend it to be an exciting leader in the coming what I believe in call the trillion-dollar crop. That's what Jack Hare called it. And it is truly a trillion-dollar economy that I believe is coming. And we all hope and work towards that vision that, you know, we see hemp being able to shape out. So without further ado, I want to hand the mic over to Josh Schneider to lead the way with episode 21 of Hemp Rising. And we have special guests here today from Kansas to share all kinds of really exciting news and updates. So definitely stick around and invite your friends to join and listen.
Thanks so much, Milan. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the podcast today Sarah Stevens, the CEO, and Jennifer Holmes, the sales manager of Midwest Hemp Technologies. Sorry, let me get that right. Ladies, welcome to Hemp Rising. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what Midwest Hemp Technology does.
Yeah, sure. We're so Midwest Hemp Technology is in Augusta, Kansas. So that's a small town outside of Wichita. And we are in the very last stages of setting up a fiber hemp processing line. We've been working on that for about 2 years, and we have a final inspection on Thursday that should allow us to really ramp up. We've been doing a ton of testing and sampling and different bales and how do they work. But that side is really exciting for the herd fiber and dust production, and that's what we're going to make over there. And then we have a second building that is a grain cleaning building, and on that side of the facility is licensed differently by the Kansas Department of Agriculture as a food production facility. And so there we're taking hemp grains right from Kansas fields and sorting them by black seed and green seed and cleaning out rocks and dirt. And then processing those seeds into sometimes just selling the seeds whole for sure. And we're having a lot of interest in the immature green seeds for animal food for people with hobby farms in the area. There's some restrictions against selling that to commercial food production facilities right now for their animals, but we are seeing growing interest among our neighbors in that side. But then the seeds we're also processing into hemp seed oil and hemp seed protein powder. And we're doing that and all the retail products under the brand name Hempy's Heart.
Wow. So you guys are really involved in a whole bunch of pieces of the industry. Is that a challenge to manage the kind of multi-stream flow?
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges with hemp, and it's all, you know, very and very much in its infancy. We've also taken a pretty active role in outreach and education in the state, working directly with farmers and growers and prospective farmers, grain elevators, just the other pieces of the overall supply chain that have to develop in order for the industry to be successful. So you can't just open a processing facility and not have some growers that are at least interested and on the ride with you. And we've tried to work really hard on that side of it as well.
That's awesome. We in our pre-call, we talked a little bit about the regulatory challenges in Kansas, and I want to get to that. But I would love to hear kind of tell me a little bit about what each of you do, what your roles are in the company.
Yeah, Jennifer, jump on.
Hi there. Well, my role as a sales manager and business development, really, forming relationships, connecting different businesses, trying to build that supply chain through innovation of others. And we love to see it, honestly. So that following each trail of product that goes out, it can be overwhelming, but you know, we just try to pull back and we have a certain product and that's what we do and that's where we focus. So
that's awesome. What, Sarah, what attracted you to the hemp industry? What what brought you into this challenging world that we're dealing with these days?
I'm a personal fan of cannabis products and think that they serve my life well in many ways. So when you could first grow industrial hemp in Kansas, it was in 2019. So the licensing came out in 2018 late, and you had to submit a research proposal in order to get a grower's license. So for 2 years, two seasons, 19 and 20, I had a research grower's license from the Kansas Department of Agriculture. And just as part of growing, studied different things like growing hydroponically and versus in soil. We did some cloning experimentation. And you didn't have to really prove anything as a result of that research to the Kansas Department of Agriculture. You just had to be engaged in it. And so I was doing that in an indoor growing in a metal building with CBD specific varieties. And going to events with traditional production farmers there who are, you know, wearing their overalls and talking about walking their fields, picking out males. And so I didn't know a ton about the true industrial varieties at that time, but I could see that something, you know, farmers that I know that grow wheat are not going to be walking fields, picking out males and, you know, laying down drip tape and building raised beds and putting plastic on every row and putting whole plants in the ground. I mean, it just, you could see how this was going to kind of shake out. And so I still am an advocate on the CBD and THC side. I still love the value that that side of the plant offers. But in Kansas, on traditional farms with farmers that are growing corn and soybeans and wheat and looking for a healthy rotation in their fields, hemp is like the best problem solver available. And so the more I learned, the more interested I got. So then in 21 and 22, we had some different research going on that was grant funded where we were working on production farms, five of them across the state. We're comparing results based on environmental factors and soil qualities. We narrowed in on fewer varieties. We started with six varieties and then this last season just had two to compare. So for the past 2 years, we've really been doing infield research on mostly grain forward varieties on production farms in Kansas that are spread out across the state. And with that, we see much less success this season. We did in Western Kansas. This is under a severe drought. And so there was a 10 acre section that didn't do well there. But then as you moved further east in those fields that we studied, the results were much better this season and much better than the season before. We are definitely learning a lot of important things, I think narrowing in on the genetics. And it's just so exciting to see a brand new industry come together around such a promising plant that's just so full of solutions. Like Jennifer was saying, we talk to innovative people every day that want to see how hemp goes into what they want to do. We talked to a doctor not too long ago who's trying to figure out how to make a biodegradable suture out of the hemp fiber. And I have no idea if that would work, but I send them some fiber, send them some recommendations on someone that might be able to spin it that Jennifer knew, and, you know, let him see where it goes. So that those conversations are pretty energizing. So the more you know, the more excited I think anyone gets about this industry.
That's awesome. Jennifer, as the sales manager, what is the model for you in outreach to customers? Are you going and talking to people to try to bring them in, or are they coming to you?
It goes both ways. You know, if I see someone posting or talking about something very interesting, you know, they're going to receive an email from me trying to set up a call to see what they're doing. How can we work together? You know, if someone's on the East Coast and they have the same processing that we do, they can fill an order over there and save thousands on logistics. There are different ways that I try to narrow in, you know, what product can go where, how fast, but it's really exciting.
That's so cool. How, do you have a background in agriculture, or is hemp your first ag engagement?
So in high school and out of high school, I did a lot of farming, conventional farming. I grew up in Kansas, but my hemp background started when I was in Oregon. I had just finished nursing school, went to school for a doctor that was replacing hips and knees, and he was giving his patients CBD. I discovered this in the back counter. I said, "What is this?" So I would kind of encourage people to start using it, and they were starting to cancel their surgeries. And then we had an elderly man, 98 years old, they were going to cut into, and I thought, okay, you cannot give this guy new hips. One, he may not survive, or his hip is going to last him 2 months. You know, we don't, he doesn't have a long life expectancy left. So I thought, this is not for me. I cannot do this. And I went to a CBD research lab and then to work for a prominent grower in Southern Oregon. And here I am.
Wow. And
back in Kansas.
there's so many jokes that Milan and I made to each other trying to come up with the title for this show.
Don't tell us that.
I said, you know, yes. We're not in Kansas anymore. But I said, I'm sure
Toto, like Toto.
They're sick. They're sick of hearing these Wizard of Oz jokes.
Well, then I was like trying to say like the Glendas, you guys, you guys are like the, I'm like, but I don't want to refer to them as witches in any way, you know, but you really are like there with it. You know, I see it's like the, you've got the magic wand, but you know, or you're building the magic wand. It's you guys are just doing so much, and I'm so excited to have you here. So yeah, you'll go ahead, Josh. Keep pressing on. They've got a lot of really good stuff to share.
Well, let's talk a little bit about varieties, because this has been, you know, when we all kind of started out in the CBD side, in after the Farm Bill, it was such a free for all, with so many varieties. And as somebody who comes from a background of plant breeding, it kind of made me crazy. And that's why I got into the clone business, because I thought it would offer, early on in the process of building an industry, it would offer people more predictability. And it seemed to me that predictability was a really important piece for people early on, to be able to have some surety, to not have it be like a grab bag of maybe it will be compliant, maybe it won't. We had so many customers who called us having bought feminized CBD seed, and it ended up all being male and high THC. I mean, just mess. But now that we're kind of moving, the industry seems to be growing beyond CBD, and fiber and grain are booming. And so with so much interest, that is an even greater challenge, I think, because there are so many more factors to consider. How have you helped your farmers navigate the variety choices?
Well, I think the problem that you identified is big and quite substantial, something really important to solve, because like I mentioned, we tried six different varieties in 2021 of fiber and grain forward varieties and had limited success, but also we had other factors that were variables, like there was over a month long planting window. I already described the different fields around the different parts of the state, so that automatically meant different temperatures and rainfall and soil conditions. So we had limited success, but I also know a lot of it had to do with our technique, but it also, we were using seeds from Europe and seeds from Canada and seeds from Colorado. So we know that there's a lot of solutions and feral varieties that you can find across the state of Kansas. And many people have used them to develop varieties that are successful and do produce a ton of grain. You still, even with those plants, like we talked about, they're designed naturally. They're shattering their seeds over a really long window of time. So even though native plants hold a ton of keys for us, they still need years of breeding in order to tighten up those qualities that are most desirable. So just generally being 60 years behind in the genetic development of the plant creates problems for harvesting. You're harvesting seeds, some are green and some are falling on the ground. The plant's not drying down at the same time. Things that will be solved through genetic developments over time. And that's exciting. That's a huge opportunity. We've worked with New West Genetics this last, in 2022, we had two of their varieties, 2730 and 2463, had much better success across the state, did still have failure in Western Kansas, like I described, but all of these fields are non-irrigated. We'd like to make non-irrigated land a viable option in industrial hemp. Certainly you can better control your success if it is irrigated, but we certainly see a lot of native varieties thriving on unirrigated land. So that's the goal. And I just appreciate you highlighting the problems in genetics. And I'm happy to always, like, our the research that we had available on the different varieties, I have that to share. And I also, we pay attention to the multi-state variety trials that Kansas State is part of down at the Pure Horticulture Center. So that's a pretty good resource if someone's looking for genetic recommendations. And also, if you're growing for fiber, you're going to pick something different than the ones that we've tested out. We've tested all grain forward varieties.
Right, definitely. And it is a challenge because your genetic is your most important detail aside to the soil health. Because what you have is growing here. And when you bring in international genetics, you know, that I still don't know what that will do to our land race population. I'm all for it though. I just don't want to see those plants turning hot or making something, you know, where someone has to burn down or disc under 400 acres because they're over the THC limit. But, the grain size is a smaller size in the land race. And we find that the CBD variety really needs to breed with our land race to develop that large seed for a better grain production.
That makes sense. It's, I mean, Europe has had a much longer, and China have had a much longer horizon. They didn't go through the prohibitionist phase. And so their plant breeders have actually been able to breed a lot more generations and select for the characteristics that are important in those territories. But when you consider the latitude of Poland and the Ukraine, the Northern European varieties are much more likely to be useful and applicable in Canada rather than in the U.S. I mean, when you consider latitude, Rome is on the same latitude as New York City. And so we have this mentality that Germany is central Illinois, and it's more like central Saskatchewan. And so, you know, the challenges come with breeding, and I think the variety choice, and I hope that we're learning that, you know, plant breeding is not something that can be done overnight, and that's what drove me nuts with CBD, where people were like,
and that's why they go hot. Yes. Right. Unstable genetics. Exactly.
Yeah, well, and also, like, sometimes that's just the way that it, you know, we're not going to escape that. And so, for instance, on CBD varieties, the THC level is more relevant. In my opinion, the pearl-clutching approach of regulators about the potential of grain and fiber crops to go hot is utterly moronic. Because it's also irrelevant. It's not, the cannabis supply chain is not at risk.
Right. And the energy is going to the seed, you know, for the grain production. It is pretty wild.
Yeah. And I mean, and I look at, you know, this maybe this is a good time to pivot to some regulations talk.
That's what I was gonna say.
But like I don't know if you guys have seen the Peels company, but you can extract CBD from orange peels. And I don't see the Florida Department of Agriculture flipping out or needing the smelling salts or a fainting couch over that. even though there, I mean, there's a company, if you Google Peels CBD, there's a company that does zero THC CBD that's still a phytocannabinoid. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of the argument around the grain and fiber exemption, which, you know, we can and have debated in our industry for ages, is that we think that there should be a fit for purpose approach. So if you designate that you're just doing grain or just doing fiber or you're doing a dual crop, you shouldn't have to have a compliance test. And so we've seen some movement by USDA. USDA seems to be happy to support a different approach to compliance and not worrying about farm gate testing if there's some other way to ensure compliance. What have you seen in Kansas? How has the state reacted to the hemp industry and the risks of hot crops?
I think we're starting to really see there's so many things, like we've said before, that are just like a year or two off from really being a huge domino that's going to fall and make so many markets opened up. And there's so much of it coming together, but you're just trying to hope that it's all rising at the same time and at somewhat of an equal pace. But Kansas, I mean, the Kansas Department of Agriculture, they hosted recently a hemp stakeholders meeting, and they did one in the summer and one in December. They brought any industry people that together, and anybody could come really, but trying to just navigate what would a fiber and grain separation look like, because we don't have medical cannabis, like you mentioned. So we only have one set of regulations for CBD and fiber grain. And I think everyone can see that that needs to be split up. So we have a little bit of momentum around changing that legislation in the state this year. We've tried to work with Morgan and the Hemp Feed Coalition to understand the language that they used in Montana. We see other states around us, Oklahoma, and I think you told me Texas the other day, are getting ready to make hemp and animal feed seed mill approved. We've got to do that in Kansas. So we're actively working on that. I hope we can change it this session. Kansas legislature is, you know, slow, and it's a really short session. It ends in May. It starts in January, ends in May. So we have momentum. I hope it'll happen. But if not, we'll definitely keep working on it. But because we're regulated, like we're CBD growers, CBD processors, it is very excessive when what you have on site is bales that look like hay and seeds. That's all that we have at the facility, but yet we still have 14 days of video camera footage and fingerprints and background checks and a consent to search on file for every employee that even has access to the building. It's excessive. I think the regulators understand why it's not a good fit for what we're doing, and it's unnecessary, and we're working to change it. But it's new, and it's unsettled space. So we just try to see the opportunity to be involved in the conversation and help navigate it the way that we'd like to go. It's frustrating at times, but there is so much opportunity around it, and it's not going to be perfect out of the gate, you know? So we're going to have to work at just continuing to finesse those laws to where they match the, what, how did you describe it? Fit for the purpose approach. Okay. That's a beautiful language. I wrote it down.
Right. It is. Well, and look back at genetics for a second. In Kansas, you cannot collect that landrace genetic. And that is a smart plant that knows how to grow here in the sand with little rain, or, you know, depending on the season, it comes back every year in huge fields. And that's one thing that we would like to see changed as well.
Right. And that's a really interesting model, because, I mean, I worked for a large nursery doing ornamental plant breeding for years. And one of the things we did to kind of reinvigorate much of over many years, seed-raised bedding plants became a little bit sickly and sad. Mm-hmm. Because the whole point was they needed to be convenient to produce. And so the only thing that mattered is whether they worked for the grower. They were short, they flowered early, they shipped well, they looked good on the bench, but how did they perform for the consumer? Nobody really cared except for the consumer, and it was too late once they bought the plants. And so the company that I worked for was called Proven Winners. And their model was plants that were selected based on their performance in the garden for the consumer. And we would figure out how to get them produced into market, you know, and do the hard work that that entailed. And so by going back and finding wild species, landrace strains, or populations, and back crossing it into the more highly bred varieties, you created a hybrid vigor that really was a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
And Proven Winner sells, I don't know, 500 million ornamental plants a year.
Wow.
Now. And it's because, and they changed the whole industry. So those landrace populations are so important, and the varieties that can be bred with them are really important as well. And I know, you know, John McKay at New West and I have talked about this in the past. They've done some great work breeding wise, sorting through all the genetics to create varieties. And I think that that's such a critical piece for the future of the industry, to focus on variety selection and variety trials. Again, in ornamentals, we have university trials where all the new varieties that are brought to market are trialed every year at maybe 30 universities around the US up against benchmark varieties that are the industry standards. And then mid to late summer, half of the horticulture industry does a pilgrimage to their regional trials to evaluate how the plants have grown compared to what we know. And that allows growers to kind of adjust in their head what, if they do take on these new varieties, what they need to do to change. So tell me a little bit about the variety trials that you guys were involved in and kind of what your goals are for the future.
Well, the goal was definitely to study the varieties. In 2021, we had the six different varieties. And then in 2022, we just had two varieties of New West genetics. And then the other goal, you know, well, there were a lot of them really, but we developed from those two seasons a planting guide that is free to download on the Kansas Hemp Consortium's website. We also hosted, through this grant funding that was part of the overall season, we hosted webinars and a field day that anyone could attend this last year. Those were really good. And you can find the recordings for them so you can watch. We've had entomologist Raymond Cloyd on there, Kansas Department of Agriculture, Dr. Griffin with Kansas State talking about the multi-state variety trials. So really trying to just offer tons of information and resources to people that are interested in hemp at different points of the industry. So that was part of the funding, but then also really supporting farmers directly. So the group of five farmers that we had, we paid their licensing fees, we bought their seed, we paid a stipend for their time, and we collected the research out of their fields and then, you know, online as far as temperatures and stuff. But it really was designed to remove the barriers that are currently in place for Kansas farmers to grow industrial hemp, because when you have $1,700 worth of licensing fees and inspectors that come out and collect part of your crop and put it in an evidence bag, and you know, you have to put up signs saying this is cannabis, this is an industrial hemp field with your license number on it, and you have to get fingerprints and background checks. That's a pretty hard sell to Kansas farmers right now. And so the grant funding was designed to remove those barriers for this group of farmers so that they would be willing to participate in the genetic variety and technique trials. So it was really important that we had it. I think it did a lot to advance the industry in the state. We don't have that grant funding this year. We still have farmers that intend to grow. And I think the goal of the grant funding was for the crop to stand on its own or at least move in that direction. It's still a tough sell. And we're trying to get those fees down and the fingerprints lifted, just like you said, a visual inspection to tell that you're growing a fiber and grain variety. You've attested on your license that you're growing a fiber and grain variety. And then we can cease with all of this other annual inspection and fingerprinting. I mean, I myself have been, this will be my fifth season, fingerprinted and paying you know, we don't even have a renewal process. So every year, if you want to grow, you start back over, turning in your maps, turning in your application, getting your fingerprints and sending in your money. So trying to fix that through a lot of outreach and education. And the grant funding was through SAIR, Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education. And it really, I'm really grateful for that support those two seasons. Hope we can keep building on it. That's what we're charged with doing.
Tell me about what this consent to search is. I my inner civil libertarian is blanching at that. We
tried to argue because the language says about being a processor, it really has a lot of cannabinoid specific language. And we've said, you know, we don't have any cannabinoids, none on the whole property. And we don't think we should have to do this. And they basically said, well, there's another law that says you'll provide what we ask you to provide or you won't get a license. So trump that.
I mean, that's such a, it actually surprised
wave your
the
right.
USDA accepted that. Yes. I mean, the Supreme Court has had some movement recently on issues of non-compete agreements.
It's like being on parole.
Well, but I mean, it really is. And it's such a strange thing.
Yeah, so all employees that you have to go get your fingerprints at the local police station. You send that in. Then they do a background check. But you also have to mail in the consent to search that says your person or your car while it's at work. You agree that the fire marshal can show up and inspect
you. I'm already over it. I'm like, no, I'm not going. Thank you. Bye.
The fire marshal.
Yeah. Business with you. Yeah.
Well, and we lost a lot of
the fire marshal have jurisdiction.
Well, the
fire marshal is the regulator for hemp processors in Kansas right now.
Correct.
And I mean, they regulate the CBD processors who, you know, they do have CO2 extraction and ethanol going on. And maybe that's more appropriate. I don't know. But the fire marshal in Kansas has law enforcement and inspection authority. So they have the life safety side that inspect this building for exit signs and all of that. But then, yeah, they had a chief investigator that comes out to make sure everybody in the facility is on file with them and that the video cameras are working for 14 days. And it's really been a long process to get licensed. And the fire marshal knows that the legislation has changed. They're not advocating for this. They're just saying that that's how it is today. That's the law as it's written.
Right. And we have lost companies to other states because they're like, hey, we have farms up north. We're leaving. We're not dealing with
them. Right.
Mm-hmm. And right. It's become challenging because we're ground zero.
Yeah. It's driving people away.
It is.
Now, one of the questions I have, based on one of the questions one of our listeners asked, we had a few weeks ago, Mary Jane Oatman, from the Indigenous Hemp Council on talking about,
love.
She's just fabulous. And then of course, working with Hunter Buffington at Element 6, Hunter is a Native American, hemp grain and feed, expert who's focused on sustainability. Have you been able to connect with and work with, Native American tribes and reservation cultivation in Kansas yet?
We actually, there's a processor on the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation, which is up closer to the Topeka area in Kansas. They have a decortication machine that makes long strand fiber, and they're growers on reservation land, from what I understand. But then they're also working with just nearby production farms to contract acres, I believe, as well. So I haven't been to their facility. They're having an open house growers meeting, I believe, in February 4th, I think. So I might try to make it up there for that. But we see Theo and their team at all the Kansas events, and they're regulated differently because of their sovereignty. And so they are regulated within their tribe. They have a set of rules for processors and growers that they follow. So I don't know exactly how all of that impacts them. But yeah, I think Kansas, that it could be a great opportunity for tribal land in Kansas. And we did also just have a visitor that came and toured from Winona LaDuke's group named Esther. She was just came out last week, and I showed her around, and they were looking at what they might want to put together for their projects. They got a lot going on too, so I was honored to show her around and see what develops there. But yep,
that's fantastic. Yeah, I think that there is a huge opportunity for economic development with tribes, because there's so, you know, the economic opportunities on reservation are often very limited and often casino focused, especially out here. And so I've worked with some tribal leaders in California who are interested in the opportunity to create more economic activity on the reservation beyond the casino, but also the potential opportunities of products that could be sold, given the casinos, especially in rural counties, are often the biggest driver of traffic into the county. And so it's a real opportunity to build out some additional space that can provide jobs and career options for people that would normally have to leave the reservation.
Yeah,
I'd go to the reservation to work for them. And Josh, can you please just drop the gem, a little piece of the info that Mary Jean laid on us during that episode about the percentage of land? I guess inherently knew it, but it still blew my mind.
I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was a giant 80, percentage.
80-ish? Yeah,
80-ish percent of unused agricultural land in the U.S. is on reservations.
Owned by tribes.
And so, yes. It's there's so much opportunity there. And this has been where I think in many ways, tribal governments actually have an advantage, especially in a place like Kansas, because there's more opportunity to get exempt from the more moronic regulation and busybodying that the regulators do.
They're pushing sovereignty hard. That's what happened at the summit in Washington. We got to get her back on to hear about that.
Yeah, we have a good relationship with Chief William Bill from the Shoshone tribe over there in California, Nevada. And their opportunity is 1,000 times more than we have, not being on tribal land.
Yeah, I mean it's amazing. And you know, despite we talked 2 days ago about some of the more challenging opinions of the Supreme Court, but the elevation of Justice Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, a federal judge from Colorado, who has made it his mission to untangle the mess of U.S. government laws around tribal nations and their relationship to the federal government has been a welcome addition, because two terms ago, he authored a majority opinion that basically gave 2/3 of Oklahoma back to the indigenous tribes there. And so they've clawed back some of that because there were some substantial legal complications. But I think that it is likely that you see more movement towards forcing the federal government to respect the agreements that they made with tribal governments 100 years ago. And I think that there's a moment right now that can really help hemp develop while helping grow the economies of tribes on reservation land. And that, you know, the advantage that comes can really be useful. So I think that's one thing to be excited and optimistic about. Based on your last few years of movement, do you see dual crops becoming more prevalent, less prevalent? Do you think that's more grasping at straws to try and find a rationale? Or do you see Kansas being more one or the other in terms of grain or fiber?
It
depends on the processing.
Yeah. I mean, right now, there's three processors in Kansas. So we're focused on grain and we're making short strand fiber, Herd, and Dust. And then the other two, the Prairie Band and then South Bend Industrial Hemp, have long strand decortication equipment. So if the fiber market, you know, I think for sure there's potential for it. And there's opportunity in Kansas with those two processors set up. We don't see it becoming what we focus on, the long strand fiber, but there's interest in the short strand fiber now too. So we'll probably stay focused in that lane and then on the grain. But will it come together within one crop? I imagine the native plants. I love the native plants, but I mean, they're tall. They're taller than the seed bred varieties, I think, but then they're still producing a ton of grain. So I think you could breed it out and get a pretty good dual crop.
What's the difference? What do you use long strand for versus short strand? And which kind of plants do long strand versus short strand produce?
Like a really tall Yuma varieties that are 12 feet tall and just they're planted much more densely. So the pounds per acre of fiber varieties is, you know, 50 or more. And then the pounds per acre for grain varieties is like around more 25, you know, it's just less dense so that the plants can bush out and get more branchy and have more seed heads in them. And if you're growing Yuma and it's super tall, and then generally just cutting it all down together. Where if you're cutting it for grain, you're having to go through with a combine and take the grain off first. And then unless you have a double headed combine, come back and swath down the stalks later and let them rot in the field. So there's differences in the planting technique and then for sure in the harvest applications, depending on what variety you're after, what you're trying to get out of the crop, if you're focused on preserving as much grain as possible or not.
Right.
How much of a barrier is the absence of the right equipment for farmers to get involved in the industry?
We've tried to basically have the growers tell us what they have, and then we try to find the recommendation that's going to be best for what they have so that we can use what's available. I haven't seen anyone come across a double-headed combine around here. Jennifer found some custom cutters that would harvest for people that even if they have a combine, it's kind of hard on your combine because it's pretty tall. Like you can imagine the setting you would use to cut the grain head off of a wheat stalk, which is, you know, barely maybe to your knee or a little higher versus a tall hemp plant. I mean, it's going to be rougher on your equipment. So identifying custom cutters is, I think that'll develop just like it does for wheat. There's custom cutters that travel the whole country and around that crop's development. And I think that'll happen for cutting hemp too. That's another area of opportunity along with the grain elevator development. Storage and drying of the grain is a new challenge for a lot of producers and maybe something that can be fixed with genetic development, better breeding. But right now the seed comes out at an average of 15% moisture and it will start to mold within a few hours. So you have to dry it down to less than 10% moisture within like 4 hours. And that's a new challenge that you don't deal with today on soybeans or wheat.
Right. And if you cut it down altogether, then, you know, you're losing so much seed when you go to bale that, and then you have to separate it. Then you have to shred your fiber in a way you don't want to. And then you lose more seed. So you have to be very careful.
That makes good sense. And it seems like, the challenges of figuring all that out, will take some time. And so we've got to try and remove as much of the risk as we can. That's why the regulations are so important to get light touch so that people aren't put off by that. If by the way, folks, we'll be moving over to the Hemp Rising House after 9 for questions, but we'll probably go a little long here. It's so great to have you both here and resource, but drop us questions in the chat. And Milan and I are both monitoring the chat and we'll ask Sarah and Jennifer. The challenge to the next sort of stages seems to be kind of both regulatory and scale, have you been able to connect with and find value in working with the Farm Bureau in Kansas and some of the traditional agriculture associations and groups?
I know that the Farm Bureau was at the last TIM stakeholders meeting in the summer one, and Joel Leftwich is, I believe, their main policy guy, and he had some really good just sort of strategic suggestions about narrowing in the focus of the industry, and that kind of led to the December meeting where we narrowed in on how to take those barriers off and get the fiber grain, our kind of state version of that, in place. Just so we can move ahead. So I think he's supportive. I haven't worked with him a ton personally, but I do think that South Bend has a pretty good relationship with him, or their organization more so than our level of involvement. We have had a lot of luck just on Kansas-focused policy, though, through Kansas Hemp Consortium, the Planted Association, and Kansans for Hemp. And we've really, those groups are collaborating on the legislative changes that we're talking about now, putting together the webinars, hosting the field day, and just ongoing education, really lobbying efforts. That'd be the groups that I'd say are the main activists on industrial hemp. I think Farm Bureau probably is supportive, but just the nitty gritty of ironing out this language. I think they'll be supportive, you know, when someone asks them about it, for sure. But
That's encouraging. California Farm Bureau has not been hugely supportive generally. Though they do have, you know, a lot of their members were very interested, you know, it's a huge state. And so you have 58 counties that have their own Farm Bureau.
Oh, wow.
And San Diego is seen as the quote most liberal, which is hilarious because farmers in San Diego County are definitely a conservative lot, but you know, they're like, hey, this is a crop that we can make a profit on. We want to be able to grow it. But one of the challenges has been because many times the farm bureaus were not welcoming, very few hemp and cannabis growers have actually joined the Farm Bureau because they didn't feel welcome. Which means then that the Farm Bureau had no one to give voice to the interests of the hemp growers.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy, so that whatever came through in terms of legislation that would be incredibly damaging, the state legislators would ask the Farm Bureau for their opinion. And like AB 45, the disastrous Cecilia Aguiar Curry sponsored bill that has basically destroyed the CBD industry in California and made criminals out of everybody selling CBD, got the endorsement of the Farm Bureau and Vote Hemp and the Roundtable, because they had some sort of fever-like vision that it was going to solve everything. Because, you know, in California, more government is always the answer. And that would be a solution if our government was competent. But they're not. And so they just... everything is more question marks. And so it's really been a hard lift in our state. And one of the things that has actually helped bring the Farm Bureau around is really pushing farmers to join the Farm Bureau, mm-hmm. because it's a member-driven organization. And that is how we help change minds. And it's been really impressive in San Diego, some of the people that have just really done the Lord's work here, being kind of lone voices in the wilderness, have really brought around, it took a few years, but it really brought our Farm Bureau around. And they were the one group that in the state that came out against AB 45. And so I really do think that there's a lot of opportunity to engage with the groups that may not be as friendly. How have former cannabis growers interfaced with the hemp industry in Kansas? Has that, in California, there's a lot of people who have gone from cannabis, THC cannabis, to hemp. But without a regulated cannabis space in the state of Kansas, I would imagine that would be less of a problem. Has it been more traditional ag people in hemp, or do you have quite a few people with cannabis experience?
Well, the first 2 years of the licensing, so 2019, 2020, there were 220 growers in Kansas, right around there both years. And 90%, probably 95% of them were growing for floral material. So you put that on your application so statistically they can see who's doing what. And now it's basically, well, the number of acres is way down from there, and the number of licensed growers is down from the first year, which was the peak. But I believe heading back in the right direction. So we're down to about 58 growers and 560 acres of harvested industrial hemp in Kansas. So we've really got a long way to go towards scaling. It's the potential is huge, but the right now is really kind of abysmal. But there was only 400 and some acres last year. So like I said, I feel like headed in the right direction.
Are CBD products legal?
But we did not have THC in it, or you weren't allowed to have any THC in it for a while. I think just in the last year or two, Sarah, right? That THC was, you could have like a full spectrum product.
Yeah, we have that. There is, you know, a lot of people think that medical cannabis will happen this year in Kansas, or would at least pass. And that would be, I believe, good for the hemp industry. I stay involved in the Kansas Cannabis Chamber of Commerce for that reason, as the hemp chair there, so that we can make sure that hemp, goings on and the medical cannabis goings on do not negatively impact one another, and just stay aware of each other's issues. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope it'll happen, but I do.
By example, I love it.
Yeah, and we do have a lot of companies that I worked with in the West Coast, in Colorado. They'll call me, okay, do you think you're going to get medical? We really want to come in. We want to do this. We want to work with you. And every year it's like, nope, on hold again. We have no idea. But also, do we want to bring in those large cannabis companies and open that door for them? Because we don't want to make every error that every other state has made. And I would wish that our regulators would listen to us. But, you know, that's that challenge that we're up against. So,
well, you guys have quite an interesting state government situation. You have, if my recollection is correct, you have a Republican supermajority, I think in both houses of your state legislature, but you have a Democrat woman who is the governor. And wasn't she just reelected?
Yeah, second term. Mm-hmm.
Showing that not everybody in America votes a straight ticket, thank God. But that probably limits a lot of what gets through. And one of the things that I've seen is that one of the ways more conservative Democrats will virtue signal their, quote, moderation to Republican legislatures is to be hard on cannabis or hemp. And so you've seen a little bit of that out of Kristi Noem. And so how has the governor been on hemp issues?
I think pretty favorable. There's a hemp advisory board that I think has a lot of authority in her ear, and it's pretty, you know, the KBI is on there, but I think there's other balancing voices. So maybe they ask enough questions and learn along the way. I think we won't have any trouble getting her support of the legislation that we're trying to pass, but it's tough with a supermajority of any party probably, but because medical cannabis is kind of a pretty ripe topic this session, I do kind of worry that maybe the hemp language will be just confused. It's always confused. You know, the topic is always mushed together. And so it could cause us, maybe that one passes this year and ours passes next year. I don't know. Who knows how it'll play out, but it could add to the misinformation and the confusion. And we're not loosening any regulations, you know, just that approach.
Right. And then, you know, Missouri passed recreation, and then it was like, oh, Kansas has interest again. So like Sarah said, I hope we're not pushed to the back shelf because of that.
That's one of the things that really worries me for you guys, especially because, as we've seen in California, the cannabis industry is very negative on hemp because they see it as infringing on their market. And so a lot of AB 45 was driven by the Newsom administration's very recipient-based approach to big multi-state operator cannabis money. And so the cannabis dispensaries were whining that CBD shops were popping up all over the place. And of course, some of them were selling high THC cannabis under the table. But the idea of California dispensaries that routinely buy illegal cannabis and it is laundered, I mean, it's such a porous system. And the fact that the state pretends to be shocked that there's gambling going on in the casino, that can really suck the energy out of the hemp movement, because the cannabis people are so much better organized and funded at the large corporate level. And so they can come in and right now the only place you can get high CBD flower in California is through a legal dispensary, but it's not hemp. It's hemp that's grown as cannabis inside the regulated system. So of course, a lot of people, especially lower income and underserved populations, are priced out of the market, or their county has outlawed cannabis and they don't have dispensaries in their region. And so that's really tough. I think that and we saw that with safe banking. If we had delinked safe banking for marijuana, for regulated marijuana, from hemp, it likely would have gotten through in the omnibus bill. But instead, it was the subject of lots of virtue signaling. And so we lost safe banking. And I don't see it passing in this Congress either. So have you guys, have the state hemp organizations banded together to hire lobbyists? Or are you all more citizen lobbyists, where you're kind of tag teaming in the state house?
The cannabis chamber has a lobbyist, and then the hemp groups, Kelly Ripple is a registered lobbyist, so, and really an expert on like the actual language of regulation, and sits on the hemp advisory board. So he's really done an exceptional job of trying to just make changes, but it is such a mushed up space. We don't have any regulation of CBD products. We have the Attorney General sent out some mean letters last year about the Delta 8 situation, and they said that all cannabinoids had to be less than 0.3% dry weight basis. And that's, you know, not what the federal law says, but that was his interpretation. And so then everyone just started making bigger gummies, you know? So the dry weight basis of all cannabinoids is still under 0.3%. We definitely have Delta 9 and Delta 8 at all the shops, but they're just, it kind of depending on the county, maybe someone comes and tries to confiscate it. Then maybe the shop owner threatens to sue. Then it all kind of quiets down. They even, you know, they arrested someone driving cannabis money from Colorado to Missouri in Kansas. I think eventually that got thrown out. I mean, it really, no one really knows. And the industry is asking for the regulation, is what's just wild. We can't get it. But hemp, that's why I think the fiber grain is so important, because that would really pull us apart from the CBD side.
Right.
And then that can be what it is, which is today unregulated, as in the retail side. Right. If you're a hemp grower, you're all the same to them. But that, and then further pulling out medical cannabis into its own category, it's an interesting space. But basically what we've learned is that we have to be experts in what applies to us and really feel confident in it, and then be prepared to defend how we see the regulations in our space, because the regulators really don't know. It's changing, and it's not written in stone. If you don't like it, it can be adjusted. It just takes time and money, like all problems do.
Yeah.
Right. And the funny thing is, you're not going to be growing any medical cannabis outside in Kansas. Are you going to have
or high CBD hemp? Really?
That's right. It's not going to happen. It's not going to work, because we do have so much land race surrounding us. And now people are growing large fields of industrial, if you know, call it that. It's,
yeah,
it's just right. pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when medical comes, you won't be able to smoke flower. It's just going to be a consumable product, orally or topically. So it's really just kind of like, okay, we're not doing this, but educating them enough to know better is like, I give up. Sarah does all of that work. I don't show up to those meetings. We all know why. I just...
You'll end up choking someone.
Well, I lived in Oregon for, you know, from day one of their medical. And
still end up choking.
Yeah, it drives me crazy, the lack of knowledge, I guess. And I'll drive myself crazy if I try. So.
Yeah, it really is tough because I keep saying to legislature staffers and county ag commissioners, I'm like, I'm sorry, that's incorrect. This language will not do what you think it will do.
Yes.
And they, you know, the feral hemp issue in my mind is the biggest selling point to prohibitionist conservative legislators in California, where I'm like, if you have fiber and grain, especially grain in your county, that will screw over every illegal weed grower who's growing outside.
Right.
That pollen is going to be everywhere and diminish the value of their crop. And you've seen that in Colorado. Mm-hmm. All the feral hemp, even just from the CBD side, which is actually more of a problem, because more and more often in Colorado, as the population of hemp farmers increased in 20 and 21, you had a lot more flower getting pollinated. And so the farmers would often just disc it under. And so the seed was broadcast in huge.
Exactly.
It's the new like cosmos. I always love driving through like North Carolina and Virginia in the summertime because the cosmos flowers have naturalized in the median strips. And so it's always just a carpet of pinks and oranges and whites. And so it's so pretty. But in Colorado, the hemp is everywhere. And with grain, you're going to see a lot more of that. I mean, I grew up in central Illinois. And so you mm-hmm. could always tell where the grain trucks hit a bump, or when the combines went around the corner and mm-hmm. some corn was spilled. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see more and more of that. But I find it shocking that, I mean, I would discourage you from asking for regulation because, you know, sometimes be careful what you ask for, you may get it. People keep saying, well, hemp needs to be, CBD needs to be regulated. In my opinion, it is just another botanical product. Mm-hmm. And botanical products are not regulated. No one is checking the quercetin content of a dietary supplement. Your mm-hmm. mint tea is not, there are no regulations mm-hmm. even
lavender to govern oil.
Herbal cigarettes
right.
are not regulated at all anywhere. And
which,
so there is no need.
We're consuming a lot of pesticides and heavy metals in a lot of these products. So I can see why the Department of Health needs to step in and say, hey, you've got to have this testing for this product to go. So people know what they're getting and know they're getting a safe product, because you're not going to get better if you're consuming heavy metals, pesticides, you know?
Right. No, I agree. But I would ask you how safe you feel by the CDC. And I think equating government regulation with safety is a giant mistake, because
I
do not smoke flower from the regulated system in California, because I have consulted for too many regulated growers
exactly.
who
I've seen too much.
Flout the system. And so yes. one of my good friends used to run USDA's meat inspection division. Mm-hmm. And about 7 months after he took the job, he became a vegetarian.
Oh.
And he came from a meat-eating family and culturally was very meat-centric. And so I think that one of the things we can do as an industry is work with the dietary supplements industry, because dietary supplements are based around the DSHEA Act, the Dietary Health and Supplements Education Act of 94. And that basically said anything that was a food or dietary supplement before that time was exempt from FDA busybodying. And so the dietary supplements industry, as a manufacturer, you disclose adulterants at your own discretion, but the industry self-regulates because any bad news in any part of the industry impacts the whole industry as a group.
Right.
And will help drive greater regulation. And so that was one of the things that Assemblywoman Aguiar Curry couldn't get through her head, was she was so worried that CBD was unregulated. But my argument was, show me one example, a single example of contaminated CBD flower causing an adverse effect versus the thousands of pounds of cannabis flower that made it into the regulated system while Sequoia Labs was dry labbing. They weren't actually testing anything. They were just pretending to test tens of thousands of pounds of THC for the regulated system. And so
yes.
I would rather have somebody with a caveat emptor, buyer beware, know your source, and encourage that. To me, that encourages more craft cultivation. There's some real advantages. Vermont, I never thought I'd be singing the praises of that lefty fever swamp in quotes. they have basically banned multi-state operators from the state for their cannabis industry. And so they don't allow vertical integration. You can't have more than one license, and when we were lobbying in the Senate and House, Senator Leahy basically let us use his office. He was just the loveliest at helping because he, you know, really believed that hemp offered a lifeline to a lot of distressed farmers. And so I'm broadly encouraged that we have warriors like you two fighting for the industry. I'm so excited to hear of the progress in Kansas. I will send this podcast to my friends from Kansas who may know some people and can help plant some bugs in people's ears. It's so exciting, as I mentioned on our pre-call, Ray Cloyd and Kim Williams, who both teach at K-State, were my first horticulture professors at the University of Illinois. And Ray, as an entomologist, is just fantastic. He has been such a huge asset to the hemp and cannabis industry and helping people understand biological controls and insect life cycles and how to manage pests in a sustainable way. So I think that is a huge piece of advantage that you all have in Kansas, having such great researchers. Has Kansas State been a really good research partner for you? Have they been open?
Yeah, in addition to Dr. Cloyd being on the webinar, and then Dr. Griffin at the Pear Horticulture Center with the multi-state variety trials, both really, I think, helpful to the industry. But also we did a partnership with Professor Michael Gibson at the Kansas State University School of Architecture. And so spring of last year, he ran a senior seminar called Hemp and Construction. And there was only 6 students, and they made one wall panel and one floor panel. And then they did all the traditional simulations that they would do with traditional construction and compared it to concrete performance. And we went up for their final presentations, and it was just invigorating. But he's also getting ready to run that same class again. He has more students. It's his only class this semester, and he has a sponsor. So they're going to actually build a small, like 150 square foot shed, for lack of better words, small building that's going to be on a trailer so we can move it around and show people around the state, get your hands on some hempcrete, and also try to have other hemp elements in it, like the hempwood flooring out of Kentucky and hemp wool from Hempitecture. So we're trying to showcase hemp as a building material in all the ways it currently exists. So I'm super pumped about that. And yeah, generally K-State, they were at the stakeholder meetings. They also did the trials in the veterinary school about feeding CBD flour to cattle, which, you know, the industry wants to see feed hemp seed meal. So that study was just sort of a precursor to make sure, worst case scenario, if a little bit of flour got into the seed mill, how long would it take to come out of the cattle system? It's a lot of that that doesn't seem, you know, like not the most pressing information that we want to know in feeding cattle hemp seed mill, but it had to be done. And they definitely see the value of the seed mill coming to Kansas, and their whole department really seems like they're working hard in that direction.
Yeah. And with specialty grains, they have a class at K-State as well. Jason Watt, the professor, has invited us to be guest speakers in their class. So hopefully we're getting closer on the grain side as well. And then we also work with a local community college. They're growing hemp, and yeah, I really think it's going to continue to grow.
That's fantastic. Didn't one of you say that your family had a concrete company?
Yes. Yes, we do here in Pratt, Kansas.
Oh, that's great. And so are you looking at hemp lime, hempcrete opportunities?
We are. We're trying to put together either a workshop, for sure a lecture, with the high school construction science class. They are very eager to learn hempcrete, and as well as my family's company and his partner who does all of the framing. And so we're really just trying to get the basics, but we have a really great binder company out of Pennsylvania. He'll be coming and helping us with that education, and hopefully something good comes out of it.
Hope to pick up a new trade.
That's fantastic. That is so exciting. It's hemp just offers so much opportunity for so many in the value stream, and it continues to be head shaking that so many politicians can't wrap their head around the fact that this is an advantage to them and their constituents, mm-hmm. not a risk.
Well, that's why talking on your podcast and all the talking we have to do, it feels like all we do is talk, but it's so important because we have so many conversations left to be had that help people understand what we're doing, all the way it's beneficial to them. And I just wanted to say, Jennifer got Pratt Community College to plant the 10 acres, but then also they brought their students. So they're bringing, what was it? The Farm Ag and Society class, which Jennifer was actually a student in.
Then
15 or however many years later.
23 years ago.
Yeah, is inviting the teacher, brings out 30 kids to a hemp field. And they were so pumped. They were out there eating the seeds and, you know, like, oh, this is fine. We can just eat the seeds. Yes, you can just eat the seeds right out of the field. They were asking if they can come back and hunt it because the birds were all over. And it was just such a like full circle moment that there is, people's minds change. They open up and they learn things that they didn't know. And then they accept things that they were unwilling to accept before. So we just thank you for the opportunity to keep talking about it, because the product speaks for itself, right? If the plant has plenty of benefits, it's going to make its own way. We just have to keep highlighting what they are.
Right. It's definitely in years in the making, sitting in front of city council, county attorneys, you know, everyone, and then sitting in front of the college just by myself spewing like, we need to do this. You have to do this. You're an ag college, you know, and seeing it come to fruition is just, it gives me the chills. It's so exciting to see how far we have come when we look back.
That's always one thing that I encourage people, having been, you know, my colleagues and family often call me the patron saint of lost cause projects. You know, I haven't had very many over the last 20 years that people weren't like, have you lost your mind? This isn't going to work. Oh, my God. All the, you know, if it doesn't bankrupt you, it may kill you. And they haven't always been incorrect on those fronts. God knows that you don't go into the hemp industry to get rich right now, unless you count the richness of friends and colleagues and fellow laborers in the trenches of the hemp industry. But I really am excited and encouraged that though we're not where we want to be, at least we're not where we were. And
totally true.
And the progress, it's hard often to see as we fight in the trenches, and feel like a lone voice crying in the wilderness. We have made a lot of progress as an industry and a lot of progress with the public, and we have to stay engaged and stay encouraged. And so it is a distinct pleasure to have met you two happy warriors. and I really thank you for being on the podcast and sharing as much of your time as you've been able to. And I look forward to having you both back and engaging with you through my work at the Association of Western Hemp Professionals. We do a lot of work with the teams at Washington State University and Oregon State University. And so we're trying to develop more educational material that can be useful to you and your advocates, because we want to support the work that you're doing. We believe that, you know, many hands make the burden light. So I look forward to finding ways to work together going forward and having you back to tell us of your victories and challenges and progresses and frustrations, so that we can all help accomplish more together. So Sarah Stevens and Jennifer Holmes from Hempy's Heart. I forgot that was the brand. I wanted to mention that again.
Thank you. I
really am so grateful to have had you here. So thank you so much for joining us. And everybody, if you have time to join us in the hemp room, the house afterward, I don't know how long I'll be able to be there, but
at least Jennifer, if you want to just field some, you know, I mean, if anyone would, you know, if you please, you know, if technical questions for them or sales questions, you know, let's make use of their valuable time. But if you guys could just jump over there for 5 minutes and see if anyone has any questions, that'd be great. Thank you.
I totally can if you show me how to get there.
Send me an invite.
Milan can send it in our group text. But thank you guys again so much for being here. Really appreciate your willingness to share your knowledge and passion for the project. And everybody, thanks for joining us for this episode of Hemp Rising. Please check it out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcast. Please review us, give us 5 stars so that we get more circulation and get more people joining the Hemp Rising that we are trying to foment. So thanks everybody for being here. Thank you so much, ladies, and wishing you the best in the coming season.
We appreciate you having us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Milan. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week. Same time, same place.